In the previous presentation, we looked at the address of Paul's first letter to Timothy. That was chapter 1, verses 1 to 2. We now move to the body of the letter with verse 3. I urge you, as I did when I was on my way to Macedonia, to remain in Ephesus, so that you may instruct certain people not to teach any different doctrine. It's 7 or so years since Paul gave his farewell address to the elders of Ephesus. We find that in Acts chapter 20. And Paul is concerned that a group of Jewish Christians have been disrupting the faith of the Christians in the area by teaching a different doctrine. As he will go on to explain, he's referring to teaching that is against sound teaching, which is to say that it's not in conformity with the gospel. In urging Timothy to remain in Ephesus and to use his authority to control those who are teaching error, Paul is conveying to Timothy the call of the risen Jesus. The word for urge in Greek is para kaleo, kaleo to call. It's Jesus, the risen Lord, who is calling Timothy through Paul. And he continues in verse 4, not to occupy themselves with myths and endless genealogies that promote speculations rather than the divine providence that is known by faith. In the Jewish tradition, God's word, as found in the sacred writings, was a living word through which a living God continued to speak to his people. The interpreters of the Torah expressed their attempts to explore this ongoing revelation in developing the narrative sections of the sacred writings in what they called the Haggadah. And they sought to apply the legal sections through what they call the halakha. Paul was trained in this practice. However, not all attempts to interpret and apply the scriptures were valid, as can be seen by reading some of the intertestamental writings that have come down to us. Paul refers to the more fantastic stories as myths. He's using this term in the narrow sense which it had taken on among the philosophers of his day. Stories that do not convey truth. We're reminded of Jesus' own critique when he quotes Isaiah chapter 29, in vain do they worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines. And after quoting Isaiah, Jesus adds, you abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition. Those words from Jesus are found in Mark chapter 7. Paul has already referred to this in his letter to the Colossians, where he writes, all these regulations refer to things that perish with use. They're simply human commands and teachings. Paul's objection is simple and direct. All these stories promote speculations rather than the divine providence that's known by faith. For Paul, this means that they contradict what God has revealed in the mystery of Jesus' self-giving love, as demonstrated on the cross. The focus of teaching in the Christian community should be on what Paul calls here the providence of God. instead of indulging in the kinds of distraction and fanciful embellishments on the Bible narratives that we find, for example, in many of the Jewish writings of the period, and instead of attempting to work out who's saved and who's not saved by trying to establish one's link with Israel and the families to whom God made his promises. That was a function of the genealogies, to show you belonged. People shouldn't be focusing on what God has revealed. What they should be focusing on is what God has revealed through Jesus about God's providence. The hidden mystery, hidden for ages in God who created all things, says Paul to the Ephesians. The mystery of his will, according to his good pleasure, that he set forth in the Messiah as a providence for the fullness of time. And what was it? It was to gather up all things in the Messiah. This alone is what matters, and it's something that can be grasped only by faith, not by endless speculations based on manipulation and fanciful embellishments of biblical texts. What it means to know something by faith is explained by Paul in the following verses, in which he offers a rich definition of the true goal of Christian teaching. He writes, "The aim of such instruction is love. Love that comes from a pure heart, a good conscience, and sincere faith." That's verse 5. The aim of such instruction is love. Love that comes from a pure heart, a good conscience, and sincere faith. Though it's John and not Paul who uses the expression "God is love," from everything that Paul writes, we can be confident that he could readily make this statement his own. Jesus, who is the perfect revelation of God, showed in the way he constantly gave himself that love, in the sense of self-giving, is the essence of what it is to be God. Creation itself is an expression of God's self-giving, a word of love. When God revealed himself to Moses, it was as a liberator who hears the cry of the poor and who's determined to redeem them. His word was a challenge to Moses to offer himself as God's instrument in delivering the Hebrew people from slavery. The call to be an instrument of God's love is at the very center of the law. This call has been fulfilled in the heart of Jesus, for in him at last love has come to its perfection. In Jesus' self-giving, especially on the cross, we see a human heart responding perfectly to God's gift of self, to God's love. The love of the heart of Jesus for Paul is the love given to Jesus by God. It's this love that is poured into our hearts through the gift of the Spirit. And it's this love that overflows from our hearts to embrace our brothers and sisters. As Paul writes to the Romans chapter 5, God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit that has been given to us. The risen Jesus pours love into our hearts, and it's love that defines our relationship with each other. It may come as a surprise to discover how seldom Paul uses the word love to express our relationship to God. In fact, only three times in all his letters. First, in the first letter to the Corinthians in chapter 2, verse 9, Paul quotes, and he says, "As it's written, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the human heart conceived, what God has prepared for those who love him." A second text is found also in 1 Corinthians. It's chapter 8, verse 3. "Anyone," says Paul, "who loves God is known by him." And the third text is in Romans 8, verse 28. "We know," writes Paul, "all things work together for good for those who love God." As I said, these are the only three texts where Paul uses the word love for our relationship to God. Even more surprisingly, perhaps, Paul speaks of our loving Christ only once, in the final sentence of his letter to the Ephesians. He writes, "Grace be with all who have an undying love for our Lord Jesus, the Messiah." When Paul speaks of our response to Jesus or to God, he prefers the word faith. Love is for what we have for each other. And it's not any kind of love. It's God's love flowing through us to others. Paul sees love as divine. It flows from God to Jesus, from Jesus to us. And thanks to this gift, from each of us to each other. Jesus' disciples are to have the same universal dimensions to their love that Jesus had. This universal love is nurtured within the community of love where Jew and Gentile share in the same spirit. So love's something that comes from God to us. Paul rarely speaks of it as our response to God. In this love that God has for Jesus and Jesus for us and us for each other, is fulfilled a promise made through the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 36. "A new heart I will give you, and a new spirit I will put within you, and I'll remove from your body the heart of stone, and give you a heart of flesh. I'll put my spirit within you and make you follow my statutes and be careful to observe my ordinances." In his love, Jesus is harnessing for his Father all the energies of love in our world. It generates within us an imperative urging us to love as he loves, to love with his love. If it was only good example which we were receiving, we might admire Jesus, but we would despair of ever being able to do what we see Jesus doing. Jesus is offering us more than example. He's offering us his own spirit, the very love which he enjoys with the Father. with this spirit, we'll be able to love our brothers and sisters, for we will have Jesus' own love to offer them. The fountain of love that has poured into the heart of Jesus from his Father, and which he in turn has poured into the hearts of his disciples, is to continue to be poured out in our mutual love. This is clearly not simply a love of friendship, beautiful as that is. It's not the kind of love which we experience with people who treat us well. It's not a response to an obviously attractive quality which other people might exhibit. It's our sharing in the creative love which God has and which Jesus reveals. As Paul writes to the Romans chapter 5, God proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. This is the kind of love which Paul urges on us. In his letter to the Ephesians, chapter 5, he writes, "Live in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us." When Paul says, as he does to the Galatians, that the only thing that counts is faith working through love, he's quoting traditional Jewish wisdom. Judaism doesn't separate faith from obedience. It doesn't think of faith as an intellectual assent that leaves one's behavior untouched. To believe means to commit oneself to do God's will with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Jesus affirms the same truth. In Matthew 7 we read, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven." James writes, "Be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourselves." And he adds, "Faith by itself, if it has no works, is dead." James is speaking about works of faith, not works of the law. He's insisting, like Paul, that real faith bears fruit in love. Of course it matters what we do. Of course we must obey the will of God. In verse 5, Paul continues, "The aim of such instruction is love. Love that comes from a pure heart, a good conscience, and sincere faith." And he adds, "Some people have deviated from these and turned to meaningless talk." Instruction, in other words, that doesn't lead to love is meaningless talk. Paul can write in this way because of his own experience of being loved by Jesus. 30 years of missionary endeavor have only deepened his conviction that the only thing that counts is faith working through love. Paul never tires of advising us to live in love as the Messiah loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. As for Jesus, so for Paul, love is a matter of the heart. Its roots find nourishment only from the very center of our being. True love can flow only to the extent that our heart is pure, For true love is the essence of the very being of God. Indeed, blessed are the pure in heart, said Jesus. They will see God. True love, the love which is the goal of Jesus-centered instruction, is experienced only in the communion with God, which is poured into our hearts by the Spirit of the risen Jesus. For it is a communion in the love that binds Jesus to the Father. It's true love that we're all seeking, and we'll find it only to the extent that we find God, or rather, that we allow ourselves to be found by God. Deuteronomy 4, you'll seek the Lord your God, and you will find him if you search after him with all your heart and soul. And we pray in Psalm 51, create in me a clean heart, O God. Put a right and new spirit within me. The emphasis on truth causes Paul to add good conscience. For the heart can be distracted, deceived, and corrupted by error. Good teaching is essential if we're to learn to discern between impulses that are superficial, distracting, and distorting, and impulses that truly come from our deepest center, where we're in touch with the divine spirit. Hence, the importance of faith that is sincere. And the Greek word for sincere is the word from which we get the negative of it, hypocritical. Sincere means not hypocritical. Faith can be worn like a mask. But genuine faith flows from the contemplation of the love of God revealed in the heart of Jesus in his self-giving on the cross. Genuine faith purifies the heart, clarifies the judgment, and bears fruit in love. All else, Paul says, is meaningless. The false teachers fancy themselves as being teachers of God's revelation and God's will as expressed in the scriptures, but in deviating from love and from the life of true faith, they show that they know neither the scriptures nor the power of God, an accusation Jesus made against the scribes of his day. In verse 7, Paul continues, desiring to be teachers of the law, without understanding either what they're saying or the things about which they make assertions. Those who are responsible for teaching a different doctrine claim to be teachers of the law. Elsewhere, Paul has presented Jesus and his revelation of the truth about God as the goal to which the law was directed. To take one's eyes off Jesus, to deviate from love, and to waste energy in speculations that go nowhere is to demonstrate precisely what Paul is claiming that they don't understand. They don't understand either what they're saying or the things about which they're making assertions. And Paul immediately says, we know the law is good if one uses it legitimately. The law is good. This is an expression, however partial and imperfect, of God's self-revelation. Paul the Jew has the greatest respect for the law. It shows us in what way our behaviour is contrary to God's will. But unlike the law of the Spirit of life in the Messiah Jesus, it doesn't of itself liberate us from sin's dominion. It doesn't enable us to live in accordance with God's will. However, it does point us towards the one who can liberate us, and that's Jesus. Furthermore, the law still has a role to play in pointing out sin. We're not meant, however, to distract ourselves by focusing on the details of the law that have been transcended by the full self-revelation of God in Jesus. For those engaged in sin, such as Paul goes on to describe, the law can help. For the righteous, for those who are doing God's will by living a life of love from a pure heart, a good conscience, and sincere faith, teaching should focus on contemplation of Jesus and not focus on the law as though it had not reached its goal in him. So Paul can go on in verse 9 to say, this means understanding that the law is laid down not for the righteous, but for the lawless and the insubordinate, for the godless and sinful, for the unholy and profane. They need the law to point them to Jesus, who will bring freedom. The first three commandments of the Ten Commandments refer to our behaviour in relation to God. Paul begins in the same way. Deuteronomy 5, verses 1 to 7, tell us to listen to the God who liberated Israel from Egypt and to have no gods other than him. Paul speaks of those who are lawless and insubordinate, rejecting their right place in the divine order. Deuteronomy 5, 8 to 11 tells us not to worship images of God or to use God's name in vain. Paul speaks of the godless and the sinful. Deuteronomy 5, 12 to 15 tells us to observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Paul speaks of the unholy, that is, those who have no respect for the sacred, and the profane. Paul goes on to speak of our relationship with each other. The law, he says, is for those who kill their father or mother, for murderers, fornicators, sodomites, slave traders. The second section of the Ten Commandments speaks of sins we commit against each other. Sin against the fourth commandment, honour your father and your mother, is expressed here by Paul in its extreme negative form as those who kill their father or mother. Or perhaps metaphorically, those who smite their parents by total disregard for their authority. The word murderers picks up the fifth commandment, and Paul then refers to the sixth commandment by listing those who indulge in irresponsible, heterosexual, and homosexual behaviour. In condemning slave traders, Paul may well be referring to those who take slave boys into brothels for purposes of prostitution. We need to look carefully and ask, what is Paul referring to when he uses the word sodomites? Let's look first at Greek culture, then at the Jewish culture, and then come back to look at Paul. The culture in the Greek and Roman worlds was, speaking generally, indulgent towards male sexual behaviour. The male was considered, by male writers and teachers, to be superior, not only intellectually, but also from the point of view of physical beauty. An adult male was encouraged to have a young male to give him pleasure, including the pleasure of sexual gratification. It was expected that the intimacy be intellectually stimulating, and that the older male would look to the education of the younger male and behave towards him in a sensitive way. Most moralists extolled the virtue of love directed to boys, pederasty. Moralists condemned those who ran brothels and those males who made a living out of offering their sexual services to older males. In port cities like Ephesus and Corinth, the presence of coiffured and perfumed young men in the streets and public squares was a common sight, and moralists of divergent philosophical persuasions spoke out against what they decried as decadent behaviour. But pederasty itself was widely encouraged. The following judgment is typical. It's from a Greek moralist called Aeschines. And he wrote, "To be in love with those who are beautiful and chaste is the experience of a kind-hearted and generous soul. But to hire for money and to indulge in licentiousness is the act of a man who is wanton and ill-bred." One can readily see the dangers inherent in what was judged to be acceptable forms of pederasty. Dangers in the unequal nature of the relationship, in its impermanency, and in the occasion it provides for abuse and humiliation. However, the point being made here is that the culture saw the advantages of pederasty as outweighing its disadvantages. There's a good deal of evidence in the ancient texts of a prevailing misogyny, but there's no evidence of the kind of homophobia that we witness today. Well, what about the Hebrew scriptures? What do they say about male sexual behaviour? Well, there's the terrible story of Sodom, from which we get the word sodomite. That's in Genesis 19. This story describes a mob seeking to rape two male strangers to whom Lot has given hospitality. Rather than betray hospitality, Lot offers to hand over to them his two virgin daughters. The story is a condemnation of rape, both homosexual and heterosexual, and betrayal of the law of hospitality. The story demonstrates an assumption of male superiority and a disgusting denigration of women, but it's not about homosexuality versus heterosexuality. The same issues are highlighted in the even worse story of the Levite in Judges chapter 19. A mob wanted to have sex with the Levite. Instead, they were offered his concubine, whom they raped, mob raped, till she died. The only two passages that refer to homosexual behaviour are found in the book of Leviticus, and I'll read them both for you now. They're very brief. Leviticus 18, "You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination." Leviticus 20, "If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They'll be put to death. Their blood is upon them." Now, the word abomination occurs 116 times in the Hebrew Bible and covers a range of behaviours. Some examples can be found, if you're interested, in the book of Proverbs, chapter 6, verse 16 to 19. Since no context is given for the condemnation expressed in the two sections of Leviticus that we've just read, we must ask, what behaviour are the authors calling an abomination? We don't know what they're saying unless we know what the nature of the behaviour was which they were setting out to condemn. Were they condemning the kind of public, flagrant male prostitution that they observed in the Greek world? Were they condemning the waste of male semen, and so of what they understood to be the vehicle of life? They had no concept of the role of the female gamete. What emerges in the discussions of these texts among the rabbis and in the writings of Jews living in the Greek world is a strong disgust for the male prostitution that's also condemned by Greek and Roman moralists, and they also condemn pederasty, which Jewish writers condemn as typically Gentile. There's no discussion at all of homosexuality as a physiological, psychological, sexual preference or tendency. The focus is on homosexual behaviour. It's not evident that the condemnations in Leviticus envisage a situation in which two male adults as equals express their affection sexually and with mutual sensitivity. Well, what about the Christian scriptures? What do they say about homosexual behaviour? When we turn to the Christian scriptures, we find that Jesus has a lot to say about love, about patience, about respect and forgiveness, values that are basic to any committed love. There's no record of Jesus ever addressing the subject of homosexuality. Paul touches on the topic in three places. In two of these, he includes homosexual behaviour in lists, but without any comment. Again, we need to ask, what behaviour was he condemning? In his first letter to the Corinthians, chapter 6, verse 9, Paul writes, or he speaks about those who will not enter the kingdom. And in the list, he includes, I'll give you the Greek words, malakoi and arsenokoitai. According to the most obvious reading of the text, Paul is repeating what is commonly said by Jewish writers and to a lesser extent also by Stoic and other Greek and Roman moralists. He's speaking against the behaviour of those young men, quite obvious in cities like Ephesus and Corinth, who dressed themselves up and offered themselves for money for the sexual gratification of other males. He's also condemning those who take advantage of them. Since Paul simply lists these sins here, we should assume that he's repeating common Jewish condemnation of male prostitution and pederasty. We would need more evidence to justify extending Paul's meaning to condemn outright all expressions of homosexual attraction. A second list is the one from the letter we're discussing, the first letter to Timothy, chapter 1, verse 10. Among those who behave in ways that are against sound teaching, Paul includes pornos, that's fornicators, sodomites, arsenokoites, and slave traders, andropodistes. The first group, the pornoi, the primary meaning of which is male prostitutes. This may well be its meaning here. The second group are, once again, the arsenokoitai, which, as in his list in 1 Corinthians, could be referring to those who take advantage of the prostitutes. The third group are the andropodistes. Paul may well be referring to those who take slave boys into brothels for purposes of prostitution. In the only other text in which Paul refers to homosexual behaviour, that's Romans chapter 1, verse 25 to 27, it's the only text where Paul goes beyond a simple listing of sinful behaviour. He writes, "Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than Creator, God gave them up to degrading passions. Their women exchanged natural intercourse for unnatural. And in the same way also the men, giving up natural intercourse with women, were consumed with passion for one another. Men committed shameless acts with men and received in their own persons the due penalty for their error." This text is notable for two reasons. Firstly, it's one of only a handful of texts from the time that even mention female homosexual behaviour. Secondly, Paul uses the expression unnatural, used by a number of Greek moralists in their condemnation of male homosexual gratification that was separated from real affection and where the younger man was treated as a commodity for sale. Given that Paul was writing to Christians who were living in a Greco-Roman milieu, it's reasonable to conclude that he's condemning the exploitative, corrupting, or injurious homosexual relations that he witnessed, as in other places he condemns such behaviour among heterosexuals. He includes women to demonstrate, which he's doing in this chapter of Romans, to demonstrate the universal degradation from which human beings need redemption. It's likely that he intends to include the Gentile practice of pederasty. Beyond that, we're in the area of conjecture. To propose that Paul was speaking against adult, consensual intimacy between male or female homosexuals in a committed relationship is to extrapolate well beyond the context of Paul's time. Paul may never have envisaged the possibility of such sensitive intimacy. If Paul did think of all homosexual relations as unnatural, this could have been because he assumed that all people are, by nature, heterosexual, which would make their sexual relationship with their own gender, their own sex, unnatural. We should note that everything Paul says about love, sensitivity, mutuality, and the sacred nature of sex is relevant to the discussion of sexual behaviour. What we cannot do is take these two lists and one text from Romans, from Paul, and use them to close the discussion on homosexual behaviour as some are wont to do. The Bible has a lot to offer us, but we must discover the most loving way forward, faced with questions which are, in the light of advances in psychology, quite new. If we want to act in a Christian way, we need to keep our eyes on Jesus, who revealed in everything he was and said and did that God is love. In every scene in the Gospels, we see him loving people. He rejoiced in their goodness, and when people were behaving badly, he knew to embrace them in love, knowing that only love can offer us the space to change when change is needed. Only love can attract us to find our deepest self and grow in the unique expression of love that each person must find. Though homosexuality is not mentioned in the Gospels, it's surely obvious that our sexual identity is at the heart of who we are. Jesus pleaded that we love others as we love ourselves. If we're heterosexual, surely we should rejoice in the amazing gift to us and to society of people who are homosexual. If we're homosexual, we should rejoice at the amazing gift to us and to society of people who are heterosexual. Our hearts should be filled with gratitude as we rejoice in our differences. As regards our sexual identity, it will take us all our life to learn to express our identity in ways that are only beautiful, and we'll need everyone's help on this journey. People who are homosexual need special sensitivity because they are in the minority and they've suffered a long history of ignorance and conscious or unconscious prejudice. If we believe that God is love, and if we watch the way Jesus respected and loved everyone, why do we not love each other across our differences? Should not Christians be the first to embrace our own sexual identity and join people who identify as heterosexual or homosexual in joyfully celebrating committed love? I'll now come back to Paul, who concludes his list of those for whom the law is intended with these words: liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to the sound teaching that conforms to the glorious gospel of the blessed God, which he entrusted, says Paul, to me. The law points to such behaviour and condemns it in God's name. So does sound teaching that conforms to the gospel. The law has reached its goal in the gospel. Paul's point is that Timothy is to insist that those teaching in the Christian community focus on sound, wholesome teaching, which is based on what God has revealed in Jesus and is proclaimed in the gospel entrusted to Paul. As he wrote to the Romans, love is the fulfilling of the law. And my final comments. Paul describes the gospel as the gospel of the glory of the blessed God. He wrote to the Corinthians, it's the God who said, let light shine out of darkness, who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus the Messiah. The gospel is about Jesus, in whom all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. Jesus is the radiant splendor of God's being, manifesting God's love and calling forth praise and thanksgiving from all creatures for the provident love of our blessed God. This gospel has been entrusted to Paul. Paul has authorized Timothy to be the leader of the community in Ephesus. Timothy is to insist that those teaching in the community conform their teaching to the gospel as it has been proclaimed by Paul.